Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Did you see, Ruth, that the Pope got stuck in a lift? Did you see that?
No. Wait, no, I thought this was a jerk.
Well, it's to test the levels. It's to be quirky. But the Pope got stuck in a lift, and I'm not going to make a joke about it.
Did he actually get stuck in a lift?
He did actually. I'm not making that up. The Pope did get stuck in a lift for 25 minutes, and I'm not going to make a joke about it because that would be wrong on so many levels.
Yes.
That's the best.
Poor.
It is very,
very, very
it is
poor.
Very, very poor, I have to admit.
Because it's only about the lift. You've ignored the whole Pope.
I know what you're saying,
you know, there. There must be some kind of Vatican flaw. There must be something there.
There must be something there,
Something with transubstantiation, maybe.
Well, I'll hand the whole thing over to you, and maybe you can come up with something. Do you ever bujo?
Bujo?
Bujo. Have you ever known
Never
to
heard
bujo?
Of the word.
I can now give you a new word, because there was this piece in the Sunday papers with somebody called Anne-Marie Imafidon. Now, she runs an organisation called STEMETS, STEMETS. And basically, it's a social enterprise that works to inspire girls to pursue careers in science, technology, engineering and maths. Oh, yeah. Science, technology, engineering and maths.
STEM.
Oh, is that well known?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you're teaching me at the same time. She's some kind of genius. She is some kind of genius. At 11 years old, she became the youngest girl to pass A-level computing at 11.
That's mental.
At 20, she gained a master's degree in mathematics and computer science from Oxford University. So she's very clever, but she's also very organised, because she says, every Sunday night, I bujo the week ahead. Bujo, brackets, bullet journal.
Oh, no, I know what bullet journals are.
Yeah, but she's using bujo as a verb. I bujo the week ahead.
I've never heard that, but I did a bullet journal for about 5 months.
Oh, like one of those things when you decide, right, now I'm going to fill in my diary
every day. It was one of those things where I was like, right, this is it. And finally, I'm going to do a bullet journal. It's going to be great. And then I did it for a while, actually. And then I just one day I was like, F it, I can't be arsed with this.
Yes, well, that's...
It took me more time, because I wanted everything to look so pretty.
Yeah, well, that's what you do, isn't
it? Then I spent more time organising my organising than actually organising.
Yes, I think when I was a kid, I probably had a number of diaries which chronicle my entire life from January the 1st to about January the 6th, each one. But anyway, she says, every Sunday night, I bujo.
I can't remember who it is, but this is just off on a tangent. It's about diaries. Can't remember who it is, but someone, a writer, and they kept a journal absolutely religiously, always.
Jacqueline Wilson?
No, it was someone else. And they kept journal, and then they were talking about it, and like, oh yeah, this one's my retirement fund. And then they just turned their diaries into their memoirs.
Oh, right.
And I was like, that's brilliant, yeah.
Well, if you can do that, I don't think anybody would have been...
What's that podcast where they you just give someone your diaries and then they just read them?
It was on the BBC.
I could never let someone read my diaries.
It was a programme on the BBC.
Programme?
Yeah.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
I thought it was a podcast.
No, I heard it on Radio 4, actually. I can't remember. It sounded good. It was a good programme.
Yeah, apparently it is. But... They would, I could never let someone just read my diaries.
I think I heard the one with Kathleen Moran, interestingly. Kathleen Moran handed over her diaries, which, of course, she has turned into gold in several ways. But she handed over her diaries to the presenter, and they read them back to her, her teenage diaries, and then she commented on what she was doing then. Should we push Bujo?
Well, we'll just sum it up.
All right, let's
This girl does bullet journaling. She bullet journals her whole week.
She's not a girl, she's a woman. She's 20.
Oh, I call everyone girls.
Oh, right, fair enough. She says, anyway, every Sunday night I Bujo the week ahead. I write down everything from meetings, the meals I'll make, to how...
It leaves so little wiggle room for life.
To hair appointments. It's quite therapeutic, and there's something about writing that helps things stick better in the memory.
That's true.
My Bujo also contains my gratitude log, a box where I write down what I'm thankful for. One week I was thankful for my new virtual assistant. Another time it was the car I just bought. Do you think this is a little bit of boasting going on here?
You know what? I don't have a degree from Oxford, so...
No, so you can't criticise. I went to a girls-only grammar. My company's built on the premise of single-sex education. If you remove boys from the equation, girls talk more and feel more liberated.
That's true.
Yeah, but you girls went to a mixed...
But girls in all-girls schools
do better. Do you regret now not going to an all-girls school?
No, I mean, I don't regret it, but girls... It's a well-known thing that girls... Mm. Boys on their own don't do as well. Girls on their own do better.
Mm. Anyway, they're making a film of...
Yeah, How to Build a Girl.
How to Build...
Which is the Kathleen Moran book.
It is, and now
about
it's...
a young girl who goes to London. Yeah, to pursue a music career.
Well, to
read it ages ago. It's like producing or something.
Pursue a journalism.
Journalism career, that's... Yeah. But she's writing for a music magazine, isn't she?
New Musical Express.
For Enemy, yeah. Because... Kathleen Moran got a job writing for, like, the Sunday Times or something when she was, like, 17, didn't she?
Yeah, she started off, I think she was about 16 or 17, writing for...
Mental.
Writing for the NME.
So the same magazine as she does in How to Build a Girl.
Yes.
Oh, right, okay.
Yes, and then she started appearing on TV on sort of weird rock shows at about 11 o'clock at night, because I remember seeing her as a very sort of awkward teenager with quite a pronounced Black Country accent.
Black Country?
Black Country. It's the area around Wolverhampton and Dudley.
Oh.
Yeah.
She doesn't have an accent really at all now.
No, but she did
sounds quite posh.
Yes. But she did have a Black Country accent. Mm. And they're filming her with Beanie...
They're making a film out of How to Build a Girl with... and the girl in question will be played by Beanie Feldstein, who is Jonah Hill's sister.
Right. And apparently she can do a fantastic Black Country accent.
Oh, really?
It's a bit Birmingham.
Birmingham?
Yeah, but it's a bit more...
Birmingham.
They're not just saying it louder. It's more than Birmingham.
More. Right.
And well, they have a lot of their own words in the Black Country. Black Country's the area around Wolverhampton, Dudley, Walsall, that sort of area.
Where's that? It's south?
No, it's north. Well, it's south of
here. Yeah,
south of here. It's north of Birmingham, northwest of Birmingham.
North of Birmingham?
Northwest of Birmingham. But these are probably terrible Black Country accents, but she's been learning.
I bet she's had a dialect coach in that.
Oh, she will have done. But they have their own words, like Boston. Boston means amazing, brilliant. You say, oh, it's Boston.
Oh, it's Boston?
Yeah. Fittle means food.
Like fittle fettle?
Like fittle fettle, yeah. Fittle means a food, so you could say Boston fittle means a great meal. Boston fiddle. They also invented a meal called Groaty Dick.
What's that?
Groaty Dick
sounds awful.
It does, doesn't it? It's a sort of kind of stew. I can't remember what's in it, but I have a friend who's from the Black Country, and we went down once to watch West Bromwich Albion, who are a Black Country team, West Bromwich Albion versus West Ham. He said, oh, we must go somewhere and get some Groaty Dick, which we did, and it's like a stew. It's very nice, like a stew. It's one of the, it's what you would call poverty food. Things that probably cost an awful lot of money if you go to a posh restaurant and get them, like just pasta with tomato sauce, which, if you went down to Italy, would be poverty food, but then they make it very posh.
Right, this is the start of the proper bit of the podcast.
No, I thought that was the start, but let me
No, that was all warm-up.
Oh, was that all warm up?
Yeah.
What I wanted to say.
Podcast
was,
is about 20 minutes stuff, 10 minutes of warm up, and then 15 minutes of wind down.
Mm. Well, what I wanted to say was you go to university at the end of this month.
Yes.
And you still don't know who you're going to be sharing your.
No, I think they tell me by the end of next week or something. Yeah. Doesn't really make any difference though, does it?
Well, would you not? When you get to know, presumably you'll exchange.
Well, I chat to her a bit, but I also don't want to chat to her too much because you don't want to find out everything about someone.
No, but I'm just wondering how much you would need to find out. You'd need to find out a little bit. You know,
yeah, you a say little hello bit, yeah. And but a little bit, yeah, and say hello and just what break the ice or whatever. But also, you don't want to ask them all the questions that you'll ask them when you first get there. Because then that's the problem, I think. Sometimes if you talk to someone too much before, then you've got nothing to talk to when you meet them.
I don't think so, because I think... No, I think you're wrong, because when you get there, presumably it'll all be day-to-day stuff. It'll be stuff about where you're going to put this and who's getting this cupboard and who's...
No, I mean, because we've each got our own furniture and everything, so that won't be a thing. But we'll settle into the room and then all the questions will be like, oh, where are you from? Where did you go to school? What A-levels did you do? What are you studying? Like, I don't want to cover all of that.
No, you don't want to cover all of that.
But those are the first things you'd ask online, so then wouldn't want to cover all that.
No.
So more of the things I'd want to ask is, are you bringing a kettle to put in the room? Like, those kind of things.
Yeah.
Just about what we're bringing.
Would you ask about music or something like that?
No, I wouldn't ask that online. So weird. If people ask you, like, what kind of music do you like, that's really weird. It's just not natural. In person, it feels all right, but over a message, no.
Many years ago, there was a chap on Piccadilly Radio, where I used to work, who, and when you got somebody on the phone, you know, just on an ordinary phoning show, that would be a natural question, what kind of music do you like?
And this but that's on a radio station.
Yeah, that's on a radio station.
Slightly different, I would say.
All right. Let me tell you the story, though. Somebody phoned in and normally people just phone in, hi, how are you? Can I make a mention to so-and-so, so-and-so? And you say, what kind of music do you like? Oh, like ABBA, or whatever you put ABBA on. So, but this person was completely different, completely left of field, and started pouring her heart out about all the troubles she'd had in the family. And she said, my son, he's threatening suicide. You know, I really think he's depressed. And the DJ said, all right, what kind of music do you like? So that's why it's a question that I like to ask people, what kind of music do you like? But it's probably a radio thing, you're right.
No, it just means I think it's weird when people are like, oh, what kind of films do you like? What kind of music do you like? It's like they're trying really hard.
Mm. But presumably, once you get...
Whereas in person, I'd be like, oh, do you mind if I put this on the speaker?
Mm.
And then I'd be like, oh, do you like this? What kind of stuff do you like? Or whatever. Then wait for it to come up naturally. You don't bring stuff up like that.
I think what I've noticed now you're into this sort of chilling period before you go to university is how you've fallen very much into teenage sleeping habits.
I've not even fallen into teenage sleeping habits because I go to sleep too early to be in teenage sleeping habits. I'm asleep by midnight and then I'll sleep till like 9:30.
That's what I mean, sort of 9.5 hours or 10 hours instead of what you were, sort of 7 hours when you were at college.
Yeah.
So you fall into the sleeping thing. Apparently, children will, for the first time, have lessons about sleep amid rising concern that those who get too little of it could end up suffering from anxiety and depression. It's not your problem at the moment, because you're getting loads of it. These are classes in sleep. The class is based on advice from the academic Matthew Walker, author of the best-selling book Why We Sleep, are being introduced this month in 70 schools run by the private education group Cognita. And I thought this is interesting because the children will be given tips such as how to deal with insomnia, why they should not have their phones in their bedrooms at night, and why they must cut down on caffeine-heavy drinks, such as Red Bull. They'll also be taught to avoid naps and get 30 minutes outside in natural light every day, preferably in the morning to help regulate their internal body clocks. But I thought it interesting that it's private school kids who are getting the lessons in sleep. So what we're going to end up with is a whole generation of well-rested private school kids and very anxious, on-edge, Red Bull
drinking. Not already what we have?
How do you feel about lessons in sleep?
I think that's brilliant. It's like the one of the most important things in the world. First of all, it very well giving lessons in sleep, but if you have to get up at 6:30 to go to school, then it's kind of ridiculous.
But you ignored everything I said about devices, which every single person who advises on sleep
says,
don't have your devices. Yeah. You have your, you know, if I come to see you just before you go to sleep, you've got your computer on and you're watching some program on your computer.
I know, I'm awful for it.
Yeah.
Awful.
Well, it's how you wouldn't be yawning now so much.
Oh, Dad, I'm terrible for it, but it's sometimes I get into a pattern. Into a pattern of like reading every night before sleep, and I'm really good. Mm. And then I break the pattern, and then it's awful.
Would you?
You have to get into good habits.
Would you say you're addicted to your devices?
No, I think some people are, but I think it has to be. Has to be affecting your relationships and your whole life. Like, I would never stay home to play on a game or stay home to watch stuff rather than going out with my friends. You don't say you have an addiction to alcohol unless it's affecting the rest of your life. You don't have an addiction to drugs unless it's affecting your relationships. I think it's the same with devices. You have to have the same rules.
Right. So you wouldn't say you're addicted?
Not at all. Not close.
Apparently, Italy plans to crack down on teenage phone addiction with a tough new law that will send the worst offenders to centres that rehabilitate drug addicts. So it's rehab for phone addicts. It's getting worse and worse, and it must be treated like an addiction, said Vittorio Casa, an MP with the governing Five Star Party. The bill states that 8 out of 10 Italian teenagers live in fear of losing their phones and their connection to the internet, calling the condition nomophobia. We agree with studies showing that expecting likes for posting on social media triggers the chemical dopamine in the brain. It's the same as gambling, said Ms. Casa. Half of Italians aged 15 to 20 check their phones at least 75 times a day. And 60... See, I wouldn't know. I probably check my phone getting on for 50 times
a day. You check your phone tons?
No, well, not tons.
You do?
I can go...
You do check your phone a lot, Dad. Like, as much as I do, I think.
Maybe not quite as much. I can go half a day sometimes without...
Sometimes I go a full day and don't check anything. You never really do that.
No, I never go a full day. But
I'm just saying, I don't think it's a strictly young people's issue.
No, you're right.
And I think sometimes it can become a, oh, look at young people and their phones.
Yeah, no,
thing.
I agree with you.
I think it's an everyone thing. Same as addiction always is.
Yeah. No, I think for once, you're absolutely spot on.
For once?
Yeah. I mean, you see, I saw, you were talking about Parliament, I saw some footage of the last day in Parliament, and the number of MPs who are sitting there on their phones in Parliament, you know, the mother of all parliaments and everything. It's not Pitt the Younger. They're sitting there, you know, looking at their phones. So it's not...
Unfortunately, though, it's a bit of one of those things where it's kind of the nature of the beast, is that...
The people who've designed all the apps and Twitter and everything.
Yeah, and that's they're made to be addictive. Like they've done studies on it. The colours, the everything is made to, and the way they work is made to want you to click back on and stuff. Mm. And then there's also a thing of like, if you're in a job or something, it can be so beneficial to have like a following on stuff, and you can't get that unless you're turned on all the time.
No.
Which is sad because no one should have to be. But we say this about phones and stuff, but Margaret Atwood, when I went to see her like talking live about the release of her new book, she said when it comes to fighting against like oppression and climate crises and stuff like that, that she said like technology was the biggest tool we had.
Since you raised it, the Margaret Atwood event you went to, this was Margaret Atwood live at the National Theatre being interviewed on the release of a new book, Testaments.
And then it also had extracts from the book read by actors.
And you've got the book, you bought it on the first day?
Yes.
You went straight out.
Read a couple of chapters.
Have you? Is it good?
Yeah, very good. Mm. Very, very good.
Well, you're
good.
A big fan of The Handmaid's Tale. You mentioned here before.
It was brilliant. But before we talk about that, I think we talk about British politics, because Margaret Atwood says, when I went to see this thing, it's kind of all interlinked. When I went to see this thing last night, they did do a reference, you know, to Boris Johnson and the proroguing of Parliament and stuff. And Margaret Atwood seems to think it's awful. and just terrible and stuff. And so this is one of her lines from The Handmaid's Tale that they read. "That was when they suspended the constitution. They said it would be temporary. There wasn't even any rioting in the streets. People stayed home at night watching television, looking for some direction. There wasn't even an enemy you could put your finger on. You especially are worried about likening things to dystopian futures or to past totalitarian regimes and stuff. But it is interesting that Margaret Atwood, who is unbelievably intelligent, did say this is what it looks like."
So are you saying Margaret Atwood agrees with you, or you agree with Margaret
Atwood? I agree with Margaret Atwood, but yeah. I'm just saying that
so do you think that
you don't like to
the constitution altogether, and that's what's going to happen?
I don't think that is what's going to happen, but I'm just saying it is interesting. There wasn't any rioting on the streets. It's what
why would they be rioting on the streets? I mean, Parliament often closes down before the Queen's speech. It's no big deal.
No, but the whatchamacallit, the court said it was unlawful to suspend Parliament. What is right and wrong if it's not the rule of law? But if the rule of law is saying it is unlawful, then what do we have left to rest on?
If they said it was unlawful, he then appealed, and they said, forget it, you know, your appeal fails. Well, then it is against the law, but you can't. They're just giving their opinion on it. If you believe what Margaret Atwood said, that it's going to prorogue Parliament, and you're all going to have to be dressed up in those.
No, I don't. I don't believe that. I'm just saying. I think there's a balance between like completely catastrophic thinking and saying it's all right, it's all under control, it's all right, it's all under control.
But also don't forget, at the end of the day, it's an argument that's going on at the moment. That's what's happening at the moment. It's an argument between people who want to remain in the EU and people who want to leave the EU. And
they're using any
bullets they can to reinforce their argument.
Do understand that, but I just think it is...
I think it's
worse than you think and not as bad as a dystopian future.
You can't take anything at face value at the moment because...
But exactly, is that not the scariest thing?
Well,
is that you can't take anything at face value, and that is the end of the quote. There's not even an enemy you can put your finger on.
No, well, that's true.
Because everyone is.
Yeah, that's true.
And that is a lot of The Handmaid's Tale. And I'm not saying that this is in any way similar to The Handmaid's Tale or anything like that. I'm just saying that there are lessons to be learnt from it. Everything in the book that happens happened somewhere.
Is there Nazi stuff in there?
But everything in the book, that's what she says, everything in the book has happened somewhere at some point in history. Mm. So there's a lot of it based in Puritan New England. Part of it is communist. There's concentration camps, which is Nazi. There's stuff based in Sharia law and stuff, especially that was going on in the 80s. It's based in all different parts of history, however, but it also happens in the present.
And the testaments, I gather, from reading I've not read the book, and I've not seen the TV show, so I can't really comment, but... The Testaments, I gather, is more optimistic than The Handmaid's Tale. That's what I've
read. Yeah, I think so. That's what she says. Although, I mean, I've only read a couple of chapters, so I don't know. But it doesn't seem that optimistic now.
Doesn't it?
She's picked out new stuff from history, and she's got new terrifying things in it.
I quite like the costumes, though, the uniforms. They look...
red ones?
Yeah. You see people wear them in protests, and they're quite striking.
Yeah, they asked her about that last night, and she said, oh, yeah, it's brilliant. She is great, though. But she said that
she's Canadian.
Mm. She said that the biggest thing...
Wild hair. The only thing I
let me finish my sentence.
Okay. Can you let me finish my sentence?
No, you've finished tons of sentences. She said that the biggest thing facing us is climate change.
Mm.
Not, like, feminist issues or anything.
So that's not in the book, so...
Yeah. Massively.
What, climate change?
Yeah.
In what way is that?
That's why the whole thing happens. She said that there was floods and hurricanes and tornadoes, a falling birth rate, and then all of this happened. And she says that the two are completely interwoven, sort of the oppression of women and climate change, is that whenever things turn to chaos that comes after a climate crisis, the first people to suffer are women.
Really?
Yeah.
And what was she based that on? I'm trying to think.
When anything... So she wasn't even just saying, like, climate crises. She was saying that in any situation, if there's war, if the balances are completely changed, if there's chaos in the world, the first people to suffer are always women and then children.
Should we have a look at some of the emails?
Yes, let's.
Let's indeed. David Adcock sent us a little joke to test the levels with, but I thought it was even worse than mine, to be honest. He said,
God, and that one was pretty bad.
Yeah. Did you hear about the maths teacher who had a phobia of negative numbers? He'd stop at nothing to avoid them. See? Told you.
I think that's better than your joke, though.
Do you really? Howard Graham raises an interesting point. It's about our music, and he says, the music section tickled my fancy this week, and for once enabled me to find a tenuous connection between your two choices. The soundtrack to Goodbye Girl, that was the one I played last week, by David Gates, was indeed, as Ruthie said, a bit tepid. But Bread, that was the band that David Gates was in, produced some brilliant music, and the album Guitar Man still sounds great today. It is rare that I know any of Ruthie's selections, although some sound great, but it just so happens that my daughter met her husband at the home of Jack Steadman of Bombay Bicycle Club.
Oh, wow.
Yes. albeit by virtue of being a school friend of his sister.
Oh.
So there you go. But he says, this brings me on to my main point of the day. Ruthie's derision of your Spotify playlist is somewhat harsh. But
no, I don't. Can I just be really clear?
Hmm?
I think your Spotify playlist has got some great songs on. I think it's got a great selection of songs. It's how much you talk about the Spotify playlist that annoys me.
Okay. Well, he says you're being somewhat harsh. He says, but there is a more important point about the impact of Spotify et al. And how we now listen to music. We're now all obsessed with playlists. I'm probably as bad as the next person. But this has led to the digital demise...
Unless the next person is Dad.
Yes.
Depends who you stood next to.
But this has led to the digital demise of the album. My formative years are all involved in some way listening to some of those great albums of the past, albums that still resonate today. Yes, some of those albums contain weaker tracks, which are half the attraction, actually, because when you listen to an album, you're waiting for the tracks that you really wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something about the track order that made the individual tracks part of a larger whole. And even to this day, I can listen to one of those classic albums and know what song is coming next. Ruthie, like my children, you have an eclectic music taste which probably has no boundaries. But you would undoubtedly broaden...
Yeah, reggae.
would undoubtedly broaden your music experience by listening to some of the great albums of the last 60 years.
I think that is really true. I rarely listen to whole albums whole way through.
Chris writes to us and says, hi, Martin and Ruth. I'm a recent convert.
Hi,
and I'm... Yeah, well done. And you're doing your children's television presenting bit. She's available. She's just practicing at the moment. I'm a recent convert. I'm really enjoying the backlog of podcasts. He says, having just listened to the Twitter followers podcast featuring the Oprah and Miley Cyrus quiz. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you know that.
When you were saying, who do you think has more Twitter followers?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I forget the old ones.
It was like 2 weeks ago.
It's
barely ancient history.
Yeah. If you weren't aware, it's perfectly possible to follow people on Twitter completely incognito using the lists feature.
Mm.
I work in cybersecurity and use Twitter for research purposes and no one knows who I follow.
Sounds like he's a spy, but yeah.
Mm. I may or may not be following both of you! Keep up the good work. That's Chris in Edinburgh, who... particularly requested that I didn't use his full name.
He's just
Chris in Edinburgh.
See, because he's a spy.
Mm. Sean Dwyer, who couldn't care less whether we use his full name, says, hello, Martin and Ruth. I probably fall into the crony category. I've been listening since episode one. I've got a daughter Ruth's age, so it's been useful as well as funny and entertaining. Like Ruth, my daughter starts university next week, and while I'll miss her, I'm excited for her starting her independent life. I'm looking forward to hearing the parallels and differences between university in Ireland, because he's from Ireland, and the UK. Neil Saunders writes to us, and he says, about cash machine etiquette. Ruth said the etiquette is four steps back. He says, but I agree with that. You should be four steps away. But to gauge the four steps, you have to go and stand directly behind the person. And then, which is a bit weird, isn't it?
Yeah,
and then pace
it's a little
out
bit
four
weird.
Steps back. So, Stephen Hurst, this is on the, we were talking about sex education this week. And you never had those lessons where they put a condom on a cucumber. He says, I remember at my Rough Council Estate school in Leeds, the teacher announced that we would be putting a condom on a cucumber. A voice came from the back of the class, "Sir, what's a cucumber?" anyway, he's wishing you all the best at university as well.
That was better than both the other jerks.
It was, actually. And Chris Bryant says, "Hi, both, and this is advice for people like yourself, Ruth, going to university, starting right. university." He says, "The best advice I got about going away to uni is to take a doorstop."
I've had this a couple of times. Yeah.
Well, he says, "Keeping your bedroom door open makes it welcoming for people to come and say hi. And if you want to, you can make your room the default place for people to come and hang out. I took a doorstop in my first year, and I'm convinced it helped me make a lot of friends."
Aww. That's good.
If you do want to email us, and we'd love to, as you hear, we read them all out and we'd love to get them, it's martinandruthpodcast@gmail.com.
It's martinandruthpodcast@gmail.com.
It certainly is.
And now it's time.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Have some music.
I'm going to go way back in time this week to the mid-50s, Ruth. The mid-50s.
Gosh, you must have only been about 12 then.
The craze in the mid-50s, very amusing. The craze in the mid-50s was for doo-wop. These were four guys or four girls who would, they used to call it under the street lamp. They would sit under the street lamp and they would harmonise, no need for any backing. But then, of course, it was commercialised a wee bit and it became a sort of fusion between R&B and, I suppose, what you'd call barbershop quartet type singing, and became very popular from the 50s really up to the early 60s. And then obviously people like Carole King were influenced by doo-wop. And this is a fairly obscure one. It's Shirley Gunter and the Queens.
Come on, baby, I need your love tonight.
That's called Oop Shoop. Loads of doo-wop
like
songs.
It.
And they always used to say, they do the thing Oop Shoop, Oopy Dooby Dooby Doop, and then they'd say to the guy on the sax, "You have a go now," and there was always that little sax solo in the middle.
Enjoy that a lot.
Good. Now I'm going to enjoy yours because obviously the song is very, very familiar to me.
Is it?
Yeah.
Why?
Oh, well, let's listen to it. Should we listen
okay,
to it?
Okay, well, let's just, yeah. So this is a song called I'm Not in Love by Kelsey Lu.
Yes, that's very, very familiar to me. Not a nice version by Kelsey Lu,
yes.
But it's an almost note-for-note cover of a 1975 song, about 75 anyway, by 10cc.
Yes, yeah, yeah. This is her first song of 2019, and it's off-kilter cover of 10cc's I'm Not In Love. Yeah,
yeah, it's really nice. She does it exactly the way they do it.
But I just thought she's really, really brilliant. She's from... she was raised in North Carolina, and she's a classical cellist originally, but she was brought up as in a Jehovah's Witnesses household, obviously not anymore, and she wasn't allowed, you know, to see anyone outside of the congregation and stuff like that. She also worked with Sampa on a cover of Joni Mitchell's River, but all her songs are just like beautiful, you can imagine, and it's all very like dreamy. And this song I actually heard because it was on the Euphoria playlist.
Euphoria, you know, television program.
The TV show, yeah.
Mm. But are you watching Euphoria?
I've watched more of it than you have. I've not finished it. But
I was a bit embarrassed. I can't watch it with you.
It's so rude.
It's
literally the rudest thing. We watched
It's not a premise.
We watched 10 minutes of the first episode. Yeah. And I'm on that. But it is very good if you fancy it. It's weird if you're not into
It's probably more for your generation. But
yeah. Oh, gosh, people absolutely love it.
And what we would say is not a premise to watch with your dad. Probably not really a premise to watch with your mum either.
To be honest, I'd watch you with some of my friends, but I wouldn't even watch you with all of my friends. It's so rude. It's very, yeah.
Well, the song, I'm not... See, it just proves...
But obviously she's got other songs that are original and stuff.
But nice to hear
this
that.
This is her most popular song as well, and it's mainly because it was on that soundtrack.
Yeah.
But it's really... She's got a lovely voice and stuff.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about it. But I'm sure I played 10cc on an earlier podcast.
I swear you did, yeah.
Not that track. I probably played a different track by 10cc. But it proves my point, really, because when I played the 10cc track... The point I made when I played the 10cc track was that 10cc, whereas you hear Queen all the time, and there are other bands from the 70s you hear, and, you know, T-Rex is used in soundtracks and all that... 10cc have not quite been blanked out of history because they've still got a lot of fans, 10cc. But you don't hear their stuff as much as you hear a lot of other stuff from the 70s and 60s. You don't hear them as much as you hear
In fairness, I hadn't heard them, I don't think, until you played them on the podcast. Or maybe I'd heard them but not really known their name.
No, well, I'm Not In Love was their biggest hit. It was a massive number one hit for weeks and weeks.
Well, there you go.
In the mid-1970s. Nice to see it being revived by Kelsey Lu.
And if you do want to listen to these songs in full, or just, you know, listen to 10cc's version, then you can find it on Spotify, but you can also find our playlist on Spotify with these songs and the ones from the other weeks. You can either search Martin and Ruth or Ruthie, Me and My Dad. Either of those is fine.
One thing that strikes me, Ruth, is you don't appear to have done a lot of preparation for, you know, because university is just like 2 or 3 weeks away.
Yeah.
I just wanted, you know, I expected to find you sharpening pencils and putting whitener on your pumps and everything and getting all sorts of, you know, books and things. Do they not give you...
Ironing my petticoats.
Yeah, that sort of thing. But, you know, especially...
I've had some, online tasks, so I've done those.
Oh, what sort of online
they
tasks?
They were, some, grammar exercises to do and those kind of things.
So is that so they know what sort of level you're at?
A bit of that, but then also just to practice before you get there. Right.
So, you know, you've had some sort of communication with the people who are going to be in charge of your course.
Mm-hmm.
Ah, right.
Yes, I've done that.
Yeah. I think it was because I expected more to be done sort of writing. So they just send you emails?
It's just, online things. Yeah.
So they send you...
Because, 21st century.
Yeah, I know. Thank you. But they've sent you... Well, I'm just interested.
So, I have been doing stuff you've just not really seen.
Right. This is those hours you've been in your bedroom when you've been watching How I Met Your Mother and all that sort of stuff.
But, I've been doing tasks that they've sent me and stuff.
Is it good, How I Met Your Mother? I noticed you're watching quite a bit of it.
Yeah, I love it, you know. It's such a guilty pleasure, though, because it is crap, but I love it.
Right, fair enough. Before we leave the world of media, a bit of an apology from me to Gwyneth Paltrow. I don't know whether she listens to the podcast on a regular basis, but I did imply last week that we don't know what happened between...
When we talk about Harvey Weinstein.
Yes, she'd not spoken out about Harvey Weinstein so much, and it was other actresses lower down the food chain who sort of... got the ball rolling on Harvey Weinstein. Well, apparently she's been a source to an anonymous source to a guy who's writing a book which is detailing the investigation of Harvey Weinstein. Two reporters, they claim it's been compared to All the President's Men, you know, the book that brought down President Nixon. And they found lots of their information from an anonymous source who was Gwyneth Paltrow. Paltrow, now 46, was hired by Mr. Weinstein to star in a screen adaptation of Jane Austen's Emma when she was 22.
Such a great film.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well done, Harvey.
I hate it because so many of his films are...
Well, the ones you like, I'm not that keen on them, but this was your standard sort of bonnets and...
Oh, it's completely just like Pride and Prejudice or Mansfield Park or Sense and Sensibility.
Sanderson on the telly.
It's better than Sanderson.
Yeah, Sanderson's sort of veering a bit away from Jane Austen.
It's veering a bit surf opera, but very good one. Nothing wrong with that. It's not surf opera, more like it's quite like Downton or Mr. Selfridge or one of those less. It's
less literary.
It's losing kind of the subtleties of human interaction that Jane Austen really like nails.
Yeah.
I watch it just so excited because I just love it.
It's fun.
Yeah.
Anyway, she was in Emma when she was 22. Weinstein allegedly summoned her to a hotel in Beverly Hills, placed his hands on her, and suggested they give each other massages in his bedroom. She said she refused and told her boyfriend, Brad Pitt, who accosted Mr. Weinstein during a premiere, and told him never to touch her again. Mr. Weinstein berated her for this, she said, but she had stood her ground, kept her role in Emma, and was later cast in his film Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah, I'm surprised she got cast in Shakespeare in Love.
Well, there you go. Well, I guess she
was hot.
Yes, and also...
At that time.
Yes, indeed.
I meant to say a word after hot, and I forgot what the word was.
Hot stuff?
No, not hot, like commodity. What, like that kind of word.
Right.
She, you know when you want someone to film
her?
Hot property, yeah.
She was a hot property.
I didn't mean to just be like, yeah, she was hot.
Maybe Brad Pitt, who was also a very hot property at that time, because he sort of warned Weinstein.
Yeah, said he wouldn't work with Weinstein anymore.
Yeah. Oh, did he say that?
Maybe. Speculating.
Yeah. Anyway, in the book, it says Gwyneth Paltrow was one of Harvey's biggest stars. When so many other actresses were reluctant to get on the phone and scared to tell the truth about what they'd experienced at his hands, Gwyneth was one of the first people to get on the phone, and she was determined to help.
Oh, well, I owe her an apology as well. Cause
we both owe her an apology. She didn't...
not that I think she massively cares.
She's probably lying in a bed of money. Well, she's not, because she'd be lying... I mean, she's got lots and lots and lots of money, but she's put it into this business...
Goop,
yeah, where she advises people to steam very personal parts of their body, and she's sort of... dietary advice and things. So she's probably...
Crystals and stuff.
Yeah, very much that.
Probably like a memory foam or waterbed or something, I don't know.
Well, it would be more advanced than that. It would probably be one that had been, I don't know, blessed by some white witch or something. but anyway, that's Gwyneth Paltrow for you. Meme of the week?
Yes. Octopuses are going to kill us all someday. I had a biology teacher that told us this story about an octopus and an aquarium in Australia. The staff were concerned because their population of crustaceans kept disappearing. No bodies or anything. So they checked the video feed to find out what's up. Across from the crustacean tank was a small octopus tank. This little blighter squeezed out of a tiny hole at the top of his tank, walked across the hall and got into the crustacean tank. He would then hunt and eat. After he was done, he crawled back out and got back in his tank. Here's the kicker. Security guards patrolled the area. The staff realised that the octopus had memorised the security guard's routine. It would escape and be back between the guards' round. Crazy. How scary are octopuses?
Well, they've got 8 legs.
Yeah.
We ought to say, before we go, that we'll be back next week.
Yeah.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. And if you want to get in touch with us, as we already said, martinandruthpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you.